He was a quiet, kind man, and he could carve just about anything you wanted out of wood. And every year he would always share produce and things, fruit of his abundant garden. His wife was also among the kindest people that Elizabeth and I ever knew. And she made wonderful quilts, pies, and great fruit pizzas. There was also this elderly lady that would never let you leave her house without giving you something. I recall many times my parents would visit. It would usually be on the Sabbath afterwards, and she would always give me one of three things. It was either a little can of coconut macaroons, one was a Nutter Butter, you know, those little wafer peanut butter things, and then, or a little bottle of orange juice, this little personal bottle of orange juice. And in fact, giving was such a major part of her character, that's how she de-leavened. She would bring her leavening to church beforehand and give it away, which I don't recommend that, by the way. That's not how we do it. But then there was that man in the congregation who was always among the first to welcome you into the congregation, happily. I mean, he was always joyful. And then he would listen to the services, but during the services, he would sketch these pretty cool characters and faces on the styrofoam coffee cup, and he would always give it to somebody before he would leave. And then, of course, there was the elder. The elder who, when you'd get him going, he would tell you the same story maybe you had heard 30 times before, but he would tell it to you with as much passion and energy as if he was reliving it, you know, as if it was the first time he was telling you the story. Now, these are just a few of the wonderful people from my past, and the list could continue on to include you all here in Spokane and Chihuahua. And I could tell you each of those people's names. You wouldn't know them, and many wouldn't. You would not be able to tell their name. Now, there are other individuals that could be added to that list, too, who made just as much of an impact in my memory and my life, but I couldn't even begin to tell you what their name was. I either never learned it, or it's long forgotten to memory. Like the person at church who left an envelope of cash in our seat one Sabbath. The man I saw at every feast growing up as a kid who could barely walk or communicate because of his disability, but he looked so happy to be there. And then there was the elderly woman sitting alone at the feast in England one year that Elizabeth and I had chatted with for a few minutes after services, who had an interesting story and an interesting history and seemed like she needed someone to talk to at that moment, but we soon said our goodbyes. And to this day, I regret not inviting her out to dinner or getting to know her a little more. You know, our paths cross with so many people throughout our lives. Some we get to know very well, others or just passing. But it is often the impact of that path crossing that sticks with us, even if the name does not. Now, over the years, Elizabeth and I have moved quite a bit, mostly my fault. We've moved to new areas. It just seemed like every 2 years or so we moved. And so we always had the opportunity to go into a new congregation and get to meet people. Well, with that comes the challenge of trying to remember names, right? This can be very challenging. It is personally for me. It's a challenge of me because it's the faces we remember, but the names we forget. When you meet someone new and you carry on a conversation, perhaps at the end of that conversation you say, what was your name? What was your name? And that's the title of our sermon today. What was your name? We asked that in hopes that it would stick somewhere in our memory at some point. And just like the path of life that we walk, and through the text of the Bible, when you're reading through, your path crosses quite a few people. Some you get to know very well, and others only in passing. Names of people never told to you and I that leave us perhaps asking, what was your name? Who were you? Though their names are not known to you and I, their example is preserved within the words of God. I'd like to today come alongside a few of those individuals, and I hope that we can walk away from their stories with some lessons learned, both from not only from them, but also from the other people that you find within their narrative. And often those other people that you'll learn lessons to from as well are named, but we're going to look at their narratives. Before we meet those folks, let's go to Genesis chapter 11. Because in Genesis chapter 11, I want to begin here with establishing a principle and also a warning for us to consider. Genesis chapter 11, and we'll begin in verse 3. Then they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And then what follows, their stated motivation is singular and very revealing. In verse 4, and they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city, a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad and we face over the face of the whole earth." Then, of course, the Lord comes down and confuses their language and scatters them abroad. "But let us make a name," they said, "for ourselves." Now, the Hebrew word used for name does mean that, but it goes much deeper than that because it carries a broader sense of reputation, of renown, of character. Depending on the context, it talks about character. And from Genesis to Revelation, you find that names represent reputation and character rather than just a label. Let us make a name for ourselves. And this Babel mindset has been a part of humankind's character, it seems, since the beginning. You know, culture around us seems to be obsessed with being seen. There have been a lot of leaders throughout time and even today that are especially susceptible to this. You know, let me put my name on this and that. You know, my name must be remembered at all costs when the cost isn't worth it at all. People must see my name. And if we're not careful, this Babel mindset can also find its way into our own Christian walk. You know, let my idea, my status, my interpretations become attached to my name so that people will follow me. Now let's turn forward to Psalm 115, where the same Hebrew word is used. Psalm 115. And the psalmist writes in 115, verse 1, "Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but to your name give glory, because of your mercy and because of your truth. To you, O Lord, to your name let us give glory." This text directs our focus from personal renown to the holiness of God's name. You know, like the prayer says, hallowed be your name, as that prayer goes. And this psalm, the beginning of this psalm, becomes the biblical antidote to the Babel mindset. And is a mindset that this mindset here develops a faithful character, a settled character that persists through time. And it's about the hidden person of the heart, as the Apostle Peter writes in 1 Peter 3:4. So what was your name? Now, numerous individuals from the Old Testament to the New Testament are unnamed. You know, some estimates of distinct unnamed individuals range from anywhere from 150 to 300, so double 150. So obviously we're not going to, I mean, we could. Paul's not here, so maybe we could, you know, talk through all of them, but no. Their identities are obscured by time, and there's about, you know, anywhere 100, 150 to 300 people. Some good examples, some not so good. But today we're only going to cross the paths of only four of those folks, leaving the many others for you to seek out personally, maybe in study or maybe a sermon another time. And as we briefly encounter them, I want you to watch for three things as we go through their stories. The three things are the character traits that they exhibit, actions they take because of that character, and then the contrasting actions of the others that you see within their narrative. And my hope is that this is encouraging for you as it was for me, because as I'm going through these these, you know, oftentimes you think, oh, well, these are cool people to maybe look at. And then when you really start to look through the text, you're like, wow, I personally needed to hear that because I am not exhibiting what this person is exhibiting here. So all of these character traits are things that I personally need to improve and develop better in my life. And so it's, I hope that it is as encouraging to you as it has been for me. So to begin, let's go to 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 4, where we'll cross the path with our first individual. The faith of the Shunammite, looking beyond the immediate and saying, "It is well." 2 Kings chapter 4, and we'll start in verse 8. The faith of the Shunammite, looking beyond the immediate and saying, "It is well." Verse 8, now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, and she persuaded him to eat some food. So it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in there to eat some food. Now verse 8 already tells us some things. Number one, it says she was a notable woman. And that word notable in Hebrew is often used for kings, leaders, important people, individuals influential in their areas. And it carries this idea of great or important. One translation even said wealthy. But this idea of status. Yet nowhere within the verses that tell us about her do you find her name. Rather, just the description, Shunammite woman. The other thing you start to see is you begin to see her kindness and her hospitality. Verse 9. And she said to her husband, "Look now, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly." So she has discernment, and she recognizes that Elisha is not just a simple traveler wandering by. You know, he is a man of God, a holy man of God. And this leads her to take action. And she doesn't wait for a request. She proactively, she perceives a need, and then she moves to support it. And so continuing, she lays out this plan to construct an upper room that's fully furnished so that Elisha has a place to stay. And this isn't reactive just because she's discerned what type of person this is. This is who she is. This is a continuation of her already shown kindness and her character. We continue to see this as the story continues. Verse 11, "And it happened one day that he came there, Elisha, and he turned into the upper room and lay down there. Then he, Elisha, said to Gehazi, his servant, 'Call this Shunammite woman.' Where he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to him," so it's interesting how this is laid out. Elisha is talking to Gehazi to then talk to her. "Say now to her, 'Look, you have been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you?'" I knew it. The cynical mind part of my mind is going, "I knew it. Here we go. She's surely going to ask for something now, right? Something in return." Elisha continues, "Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?" And she answered, "I dwell among my own people." Her response is revealing of the hidden person of her heart. She did not show any selfish ambition, did not seek social advancement for her services, but simply indicated that she lived comfortably among her own people and had no special needs. Her kindness was rooted in a steadfast love and devotion demonstrated through her continued actions as you go through her story. So Elisha said, "What then is to be done for her?" Now, Gehazi makes a note here of the fact that she has no son and her husband is old. So Elisha settles on this and tells her, "By this time next year, you will bear a son." And that is indeed what occurred, and the child grew. So let's pick it up in verse 18. And when you read the words of the Bible, it is important for you and I to read them through the perspective of the real people within its pages, the real emotions, the real stories. Because it can be way too easy to just read over things without really thinking through it from the human perspective. And what follows, and to me personally, just the way it is written, is extremely heartbreaking. Especially if you were to put yourself into her story. Verse 18. and the child grew. Now it happened one day that the child went out to his father, to the reapers, and he said to his father, "My head, my head." So he said to his servant, "Carry him to his mother." And when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon, and then he died. Verse 21. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, and shut the door upon him, and went out. And let's see her response. Then she called to her husband and said, "Please send me one of the young men and one of the donkeys, that I may run to the man of God and come back." And her husband says, "Well, why are you going to him today? It's neither, you know, the new moon or the Sabbath." And she said, "It is well. It is well." The King James Version says it this way, "It shall be well." Shall is the verb of hope, as I've said before. It is and it will be well. Now, the whole statement translated here is, in Hebrew, actually just the word shalom. Now, shalom is a word that carries a much broader and richer meaning than maybe sometimes we think of it as just a thing to say. It means more than simply peace. It refers to wholeness, completeness, and well-being. Her saying it at this moment indicates a trust, a hope that looked beyond the immediate tragedy. This is not a blind positivity that is void of the reality of pain. She is holding hope in the hurting. Verse 24, then she saddled a donkey and said to her servant, "Drive and go forward. Do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you." And she departed and went to the man of God at Mount Carmel. So it was when the man of God saw her afar off that he said to his servant Gehazi, "Look, the Shunammite woman, please run now to meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with your child?" And again she answered, "It is well." Now when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet, but Gehazi came near to push her away. An interesting response from Gehazi. Perhaps you start to see a glimpse into what we'll look at here in a bit, but perhaps a glimpse of a lack of compassion, because she's clearly distressed. But the man of God said, "Let her alone, for her soul is in deep distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me." Verse 28, she said, likely in tears, Did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me?" She had faith, but she had pain. Verse 29, then he said to Gehazi, "Get yourself ready and take my staff in your hand and be on your way. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not answer him, but lay my staff on the face of the child." And the mother then said to as the Lord lives, as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So she refuses to leave Elisha. And so he arose and followed. Now Gehazi goes ahead of him. And it says that he goes there and he lays the staff on the face of the child. But there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore he went back and he meets them. And he told him, saying, "The child has not awakened." You get this sense that he essentially shrugs his shoulders. You know, "Oh well, nothing happened." Perhaps he had expected something extraordinary to happen by his action, but the mere routine of fulfilling one's duties does not mean that there will be spiritual results from it. Verse 32, when Elisha came into the house, there was the child lying dead on his bed. He went in, therefore, shut the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. Now, Elisha goes in and out, and he does a variety of things. But in an answer to his earnest prayer, the Lord gives life to this young boy again. In verse 36, and he called Gehazi and said, "Call this Shunammite woman." So he called her, and when she came into him, he said, "Pick up your son." So she went in, fell at his feet, and bowed to the ground. Then she picked up her son and went out. What a moving story. What a moving scene. And as she said, it is well. Now to turn forward to chapter 8. Chapter 8 is where we see her for the last time and where we still find her remaining steadfast. Chapter 8, verse 1. Then Elisha spoke to the woman whose son he had restored to life, saying, "Arise and go, and your household, and stay wherever you can. For the Lord has called for a famine, and furthermore, it will come upon the land for 7 years." So verse 2 tells us that the woman arose and did according to the saying of the man of God, and she went with her household and dwelt in the land of the Philistines 7 years. You see a further her taking action in faith. Now verse 3, it came to pass at the end of 7 years that the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, and she went to make an appeal to the king for her house and for her land. It's very fascinating to see how God orchestrates what some may, you know, cast aside as coincidences. But God orchestrates all of this. Because as you read on, you find that as she walks into the king's court to make her appeal for her land, at that exact moment, the king is actually chatting with her old friend Gehazi. And furthermore, he's actually talking to the king about the very miracle of her son being restored to life so many years ago. The king wasn't just hearing a story. Here she comes into the room there, and he was looking at the living, breathing proof of God's power. You know, she didn't have to promote herself or her name when her character spoke on her behalf in a room that she hadn't even entered yet. With this divine timing, the king restored everything that belonged to her. So another case of restoration for her. Her proactive faith and kindness years prior created a reputation that God used to provide for her and her family in a time of desperate need. Her story is one of someone who saw a need and moved to support it. Someone whose hospitality was not reactive, was not selfish, not looking out for her own interests in that regard, but a simple continuation of who she was, rooted in kindness. She took action in faith beyond what the physical situation gave her, and she grasped onto trust and hope that all shall be well. The woman of Shunem proves that when you focus on being a blessing, God focuses on being your provider. And this takes us to our second individual, and we're going to stay in 2 Kings. Let's go back to chapter 5. 2 Kings chapter 5, we cross paths with the captive who chose compassion, healing the enemy. Now, with the Shunammite woman, we saw hospitality in her providing for a friend. Here, what we'll find is we'll see compassion and an example of providing for an enemy. 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 1. Now, Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master. He's got a name, right? He's great and honorable. But why is he great? Continuing, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. So the Lord gave him the victory. And it continues, he was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper. Now verse 2, and the Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. Then she said to her mistress in verse 3, if only my master were with the prophet, speaking of Elisha here, who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy. This is interesting to me because let's be honest, that would not be the first thing on my mind, right? That wouldn't be, you know, what I would be thinking. Because the Syrian raids into Israel resulted in the displacement and enslavement of individuals like this young girl. She had every reason to harbor bitterness toward her captor Naaman's leprosy and say, well, that's divine retribution for the suffering inflicted upon my people. So maybe you can relate to this, right? So I've personally been in a situation where there's a manager who openly just does not like me whatsoever. And they do everything in their power to just make my life difficult and miserable. But then the day comes. Oh, the day comes when they're in a tight spot, right? They're the ones getting squeezed, and it's uncomfortable for them. I'm in the background, silently cheering, you know, trying not to grin or smirk, right? It may not be right, but it's kind of how we naturally respond to things. But, you know, it's our normal reaction. And we don't see this with this young girl here, this young captive. Her character is defined by compassion rather than bitterness, to bring healing to one who had been an enemy to her people. In doing so, she mirrored the divine characteristic of mercy. She knew that there was a prophet in Israel, and she believed in God's power to heal through him. So her simple statement was so influential to Naaman that he actually goes to the king of Syria, who in turn then writes a letter to the king of Israel. Now, as you read through, the king of Israel receives the letter, and he's initially upset because he thinks, well, this is a trap. You know, who am I? You know, I can't heal this guy. And so now this is a trap to get us into further conflict. And Elisha hears about this, and so he comes to the king and tells the king, let him come, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. So verse 9. So then Naaman went with his horses and chariot, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. Now, I love this. I love all of this. Because remember, Naaman is a mighty man of valor. He's this important guy. He's important in his own eyes, and then perhaps in all the other people that's around him. And here he is. He's standing outside the door of Elisha's house. Maybe he knocks a few times. Maybe he looks through a window, knocks a few more times. Then verse 10. And Elisha sent a messenger to him. And Elisha doesn't even come to the door. He sends a messenger to him. And the messenger says, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean. Now verse 11. But Naaman became furious. Doesn't he know who I am? I mean, you told him my name was Naaman, right? Naaman? Doesn't that ring a bell? He became furious and went away and said, indeed, I said to myself, surely he will come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord, wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy. This humbling lack of reception suggests that though Elisha intended to heal Naaman's physical problem, he also intended to deal with Naaman's spiritual problem, which is his pride. Now, Naaman just wanted a quick fix to his problem without actually seeing what the real problem, one of the real problems was with his heart. He continues to say in verse 12, are not the Abana and the Parpha, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? There's a bunch of rivers back home better than this old Jordan River, right? And so he turns away in rage. Now, the young girl responded to affliction and crisis with advocacy rooted in compassion. Naaman responds with fury and indignation rooted in pride. Now, how many times do we respond to things like this, you know? Like, we have these preconceived ideas on how things should be or how things should play out. And when they don't happen, we can get angry, we can get disappointed to the point of, you know, like we've been hearing, we get offended or we just get angry and just say, I'm just not going to deal with this. So he's going away in rage. And servants come to him and give him something to think about. Verse 13, and his servants came near and spoke to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you have not done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? So again, we find the voices of those who are also unnamed, but in the grand scheme of things, in the important structure or how humans look at things, they're not that important, and they're giving guidance to this guy who thinks he's big and mighty. But it makes him stop and think. And so he finally decides to do what he was told. Verse 14, so he went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his aides, and he came and stood before him and said, indeed, now I know Now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. Now therefore, please take a gift from your servant. So Elisha was God's servant doing God's work. And Naaman here now refers to himself as Elisha's servant. You begin to see the humbling mindset. Elisha said, as the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive nothing. He knew, you know, that this was God's work. And so Naaman continues to urge him to take, but Elisha refused. He was not going to accept payment for what God had done. Verse 17, so Naaman said, then if not, please let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth, for your servant will no longer offer either burnt offerings or sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord. So an interesting turn here, because previously he thought the rivers of his homeland were far better than any of the waters in Israel. But now he's at a point that even the dirt of Israel is better than anything back home for him to build the altar to God. Naaman had been cured physically, but he had also been humbled. And it all started with the compassion from a young girl who only you and I know as the girl who is from the land of Israel. And as the account continues, we find an interesting contrast again with old Gehazi. With old Gehazi. Remember him? So continuing on, let's drop down to verse 20. So Elisha refuses the gifts of money that Naaman had offered, and then the light bulb clicks in Gehazi's mind. Chapter 5, verse 20. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, look, my master has spared Naaman the Syrian, while not receiving from his hands what he brought. But as the Lord lives, I will run after him, and I will take something from him. So the greed of Gehazi leads him to deceiving Naaman, and then secures 2 talents of silver, and then he returns to his house, and he hides the silver in his house. Which is an interesting, when you look at people that steal things, sometimes they don't even use it. They just have it, and they hide it, right? For no, you know, just other than, oh, this is mine, right? So he returns home, and he hides it. But then he tries to deny that he had gone anywhere. But Elisha, understands, because Elisha confronts him, and he discerns what's going on in the situation. And, of course, Gehazi tries to deny it, and so what Elisha does is he transfers the leprosy from Naaman to Gehazi and his descendants forever. A very sad story. Now Gehazi was there and he saw the Shunammite woman give freely of her resources to support the prophet, not wanting anything in return. He had seen the dead raised back to life. And he had seen leprosy healed. And it's even, you know, we are not going to look at that account, but it's even thought that he may have been the servant who saw, who Elisha prayed to have his eyes opened, and he saw the chariots of fire, right? You can read through that account. It doesn't specifically say that's Gehazi, but it's some commentators say it could have been. So imagine, he had seen all of this, but yet, here he is. Gehazi thought he knew a better way. The sobering thing for me, and the sobering thing for all of us, is that when situations present themselves, it's the hidden person of the heart that must be aligned with divine principles. Gehazi could be viewed as the Babel mindset personified. His example serves as a warning for you and me today that if we do not cultivate a teachable heart, if we do not maintain that teachable heart, regardless of how close we may be to God's work or God's, you know, being here, we will not develop godly character if we don't maintain that perfectly teachable heart. Gehazi, interestingly, is indeed mentioned much more than the young servant girl from Israel. But the Bible tells us enough about both of them. The unnamed young girl chose compassion over bitterness and mirrored the divine characteristic of mercy by choosing to be a blessing to even those who caused her hardship. She teaches you and I that true influence is not tied to wealth or status. Her status as a young foreign slave placed her at the very bottom of the social hierarchy. Yet she possessed a trust, a character, and a compassion that the powerful men around her lacked completely. And one of the greatest lessons from her is that you are never too young or too small or too seemingly insignificant to make a difference, to make a profound difference in someone else's life. And this actually takes us to our third individual. So let's move forward to John chapter 6, where we'll cross paths with the boy who offered that which was insufficient. John chapter 6, the boy who offered that which was insufficient. Chapter 6, verse 1. After these things, Jesus went over to the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Then a great multitude followed him because they saw his signs which he performed on those who were diseased. And Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes, and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" Notice with me verse 6. But this he said to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. I like verse 6 for two very specific reasons. One, I find it encouraging and comforting, because when you come to a test or something that seems way above your capability of figuring out, Jesus says, I got this. He himself knew what he would do. He already had his plan. The second reason I like verse 6 is because, as we heard in the sermonette, it's what I call a loaded question. He already knew the answer, and he was asking to see what Philip would come up with. It says he said this to test him. Teachers give students tests to allow them to apply what they've learned. And when God tests us, he's giving you and I an opportunity to apply the spiritual truth to the challenging circumstances we face. Know the truth and make use of the truth you know. So with thousands of hungry people gathering, Philip was given a test that he'd never forget. Now verse 7, Philip answered him and said, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have a little. Now Philip, though practical, was focusing only on what could not be done. He's only focusing on what could not be done. And he's also focusing on the age-old question. How much is this going to cost us? That's the age-old question. Now, depending on what source you're looking at, 200 denarii could be anywhere from 6 to 8 months of pay, of wages. Even today, that's quite a lot of money. But Jesus wasn't asking about the cost. He was asking where. Where the food would come from. Now, verse 8, one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, says to him, "Hey, there's a lad over here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish." So we're introduced to a young boy who was just there to hear what Jesus had to say. He was just there to hear the words of Christ, which is a lesson in itself. But while the disciples were calculating the impossibility of the situation, this young boy was ready to act. He was ready to act. And the character of the unnamed boy is found in his ready and willing ability to help and give. Not just a portion of what he had, he was going to give it all, without really knowing at all how the problem would be solved. He didn't look at the 5 loaves and 2 fish and think, this isn't enough, might as well eat it. Someone else will come up with something, I'm sure. No, he simply recognized that he had a part to play, however small it seemed. And this simple act of faith and generosity was something that could be used by Christ, who knew what he was going to do with such a small gift. Verse 9, "There is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish," Andrew says, "but what are they among so many?" And as they say in the South, bless his heart. Andrew's trying. Andrew is here slightly more hopeful than Philip, and he's trying to be helpful, but he still doubted the value of his own suggestion. So Philip and Andrew were both hindered by this physical perspective that sometimes can overwhelm the spiritual vision. Verse 10, Then Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down in number about 5,000. So keep in mind that there were also women and children there, so this could have very well been well above 5,000 individuals. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, now let's stop here for a moment. Don't let this pass you by. Jesus thanked the Father for what was not nearly enough. The situation, what he thanked the Father for, was not nearly enough to fix the situation. Continuing, then he distributed to them the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise of the fish as much as they wanted. So Jesus took insufficiency, expressed gratitude for it, and then provided more than enough. A lesson for you and I is simply this: don't let the lack of your resources limit what God can do. Offer prayers of thanksgiving even in the midst of your insufficiency. Verse 12, so when they were filled, he said to his disciples, "Gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost." Therefore, they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments of the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. I find it cool that there were 12 baskets. One basket for each of the 12 disciples to have to carry. Almost like it was, you know, again, we're going back to coincidences, right? I don't think this was a coincidence. It was a reminder, almost like it was a reminder to each of them, that God has provided, God will provide, and always will provide for them and for you and I. The result of this boy's small sacrifice and help was that thousands were able to be filled. They were able to eat and be filled. The young boy exemplified what Paul had wrote to Timothy, that do not let others despise your youth, but to be an example in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, and in purity. His example also teaches us to not wait for, you know, perfect conditions or a prominent position or platform before acting to help others. God values the attitudes and faith behind an action more than the physical amount, as we'll continue to see. No gift is too small for God to use, and I'm not talking about money. I mean, that's part of the conversation, right? But that's not what I'm talking about. Each of us have a God-given gift that has been graciously given for a purpose. Turn to Romans chapter 12 to add a thought to this. Romans 12 and verse 3. Paul writing, for I say through the grace given to me to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. You know, let us make a name for ourselves, is what they said. Avoid that Babel mindset. Paul continues, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. As we have many members in one body, but all the members do not have the same function. So we, being many, are in one body in Christ, and individually members of one another. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them. Let us use them. Not because we think we are great, but because we know that the one who can take not enough of our lives and can turn it into more than enough. You know, great things can often happen when we stop calculating, like Philip and Andrew, and start placing our resources, our time, our energy, and our talents into the hands of God. Yeah, human nature can sometimes lead people to think that if we aren't the ones standing on the mountain, talking to thousands of people, then the gift doesn't count. But the miracle here that we read in John 6 didn't start with the thousand. It started with a boy among the crowd, an unnamed individual among the crowd, who was willing to use what he had been given. And this actually takes us to our fourth and final individual that we'll look at this afternoon. So let's go to Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5, as we cross paths with the widow who put in all she had, the power of presence. The widow who put in all she had, the power of presence. So the story we come alongside here in Mark 5 does carry some of the same theme and elements from what we just read from John 6. But I want to take a slightly different approach to it. I'm sorry, I said 5, I mean chapter 12. Mark chapter 12. Now, the setting here is the court of women, which both men and women were allowed to come into, where the temple treasury was, and Jesus sat there, and he was watching people bring their offerings and put them in, there were 13 trumpet-shaped boxes used for this purpose of offerings. Chapter 12, verse 41. Now, Jesus sat opposite the treasury and saw how the people put money into the treasury. And many who were rich put in much. Now, notice again, it's not about the amount. We're not talking about the dollar value of gifts or offerings. It says Jesus sat and saw how the people put money into the treasury. And it always comes back to the hidden person of the heart. Hold your place here, and let's go back to Matthew chapter 6. We'll be back in Mark 12. But Matthew chapter 6, verse 1. Jesus says, "Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward." So the imagery is clear. And as we continue, it says, verse 3, Jesus continues and says, "But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly." So with that thought, let's go back to Mark chapter 12. Mark chapter 12, verse 42. "Then one poor widow came and threw in 2 mites, which makes a quadrants. Now she places in the box 2 of the smallest coins in circulation at that time. The disciples were apparently not there with Jesus, so he calls them over. Hey, come over here. Check this out. Verse 43. "So he calls the disciples to himself and said to them," because he wanted them to see what the lesson was, "Assuredly, I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who have given to the treasury." It appeared that the widow had given next to nothing, but the percentage of what she gave in relation to what she had exceeded well beyond all the rest and was more than all the others because of in the spirit in which she gave it. Verse 44. "For they all put out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, put in all that she had, her whole livelihood." That 6-word phrase there, I want you to zero in on, "put in all that she had." That could describe many, if not all, of the widows I've known throughout my short life. They put in all that they had. Again, money is not ultimately what Jesus is talking about. In that moment, it was the catalyst for the lesson, but it was not what he was focusing on. It was who she was in the hidden person of her heart. The widow's willingness to give her livelihood demonstrated her great reliance on God and her source of provision. Now, the widow indeed could have been of any age. Right? It does not say how old, but oftentimes when we refer to a widow, we just refer to someone who is elderly. Just like you are never too young to make a difference, you are never too old to make a difference. Her act of sincere, unselfconscious giving, and just her, it was hidden from the casual observer, but it caught the eye of the Savior. So there are many aged shut-ins, men and women, listening to the webcast and on the phone hookup, that you will never know. And you may not even know their name. But you know, what I have found often is they know your name, and because they're praying for you. They're praying for us all. They are among the ones that give all that they have in thought, in prayer, in study. They put in all they have. They have in life, but they're still putting all they have, what they can. You know, growing up, I was the only kid, essentially, in a small congregation my family attended. Now, yes, we combined on holy days with the larger congregation on the circuit, but most of my Sabbath experience was attending Sabbath services with just a small group of adults. And when you're a kid, everybody's ancient, right? I mean, they're all old and ancient when they really weren't that old. You know, looking back on it, you know. In fact, I'm probably the age of some of the folks, and I'm like, oh, wow, I'm getting old and ancient. I tell Theo I'm old and crickety, and it's sad because he repeats that now. He walks around, I'm old and crickety. But when you're, you know, I grew up in this environment, and my church experience was growing up around these folks and seeing and watching the presence of the elderly. And what do I mean by that? Yeah, they did things, they served, they helped out, but most of all, they were there. They were present. And their presence extended well beyond the walls of the church there. You know, because it's often years later, and maybe you've had the same experience, it's often years later where you truly learn all the things that they did in life, but then also all the things that they did in church in service to God and his people. And you end up saying, wow, I never knew that. Jesus drawing attention to this unnamed widow also carries a deeper meaning when you consider the placement of it within the two gospel accounts that record it, this event. Because after this event, the account then begins to shift toward the final moments before his crucifixion. In a way, it serves as a transition to the events that would follow and how Jesus gave his all for all of humankind. This unnamed widow serves as an ultimate example to us all of humility and of service. Her act of sincere and unselfish, self-conscious service and presence, and her willingness to essentially forsake all, is a type of what God calls us all as his disciples to do. And it was a physical representation of the spiritual requirement Christ has set before us, to follow him. So just four unnamed people, out of the countless others within the Bible. What incredible stories that they have. You know, the people I began with in this sermon, those faces from my past, and many others, there's a common thread connecting them and the four people that we looked at today. They were all other people-minded. They were all other people-minded. Much of what they did, or their presence, was ultimately for others outside of themselves. I'm not saying that they did that 100% of the time. I'm just saying that that is a overriding character of many of the people that I have seen growing up. They didn't seek to build a tower to the heavens. They simply lived the hidden person of the heart. And as you and I walk through our own lives, our paths will cross with many who are hurting, many who are hungry, and many who are searching. And you may often feel unnamed. And you may feel like you're insufficient for the giant problems that are in front of you. But remember that God doesn't need a big name to do big things. Seek to root out any element of the Babel mindset, or the Babel mindset, however you want to say it, the Tower of Babel. Who they were seeking their own renown. The individuals who truly alter history and lives are those who feed thousands, heal enemies, and sustain God's work. Those people are often those who simply step into a need, driven by the hidden person of the heart. You know, may our lives and our paths cross with others in a way that leaves them not remembering our names, but remembering the character of the God we serve. You know, years later, let them be like, hey, what was that person's name? You know, that person that was always caring, always faithful, compassionate, always seemed to be giving. What was that person's name? If we could live, if I could figure out how to live that way, If we could all figure out how to live like that, then we could hold fast to the promise that we find in Revelation. So let's conclude with Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 11. The words of Christ, "Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more." "What was your name?" Jesus says. He continues, "I will write on him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, and the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God. And I will write on him my new name."